The following program is paid for by Little John Financial Services. The opinions and views expressed may not reflect those of Brook Communications, its affiliates, or its employees.
This All right, class. Time for a pop quiz. Who deserves way more credit for shaping young minds?
Bueller.
Bueller.
Local information. That's right. Teacher.
Now presented by Little John Financial Services. It's David Little John with True Wealth on News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.
All right, gang, it is that time of the week. Wait, it is not. This is a weird time of the week. We are pinch hitting today on the True Wealth Radio Show on this, the greatest Monday you've had all week. Joining me in studio today is...
Emma.
All right, Emma, welcome.
Thank you.
I say pinch hitting because evidently tomorrow the UVO men's basketball team, I believe, is playing in the Big Ten tournament. And so we had broadcast conflict. And some of you would rather listen to the game than listen to this program. I realize it's only a handful of you, but apparently you have some pull here. So we're going to work with that, right? But anyway, we're here today. And Emma and I have prepared significantly for today's show.
Oh, absolutely.
Right? And by prepare, I mean we did have conversations about things we could talk about. And I think what we agreed to is that we're just going to keep asking me questions.
Yeah, I still have a lot of questions.
So can you give our listeners just a little bit of background on like how you've like your role at the firm, how you've arrived, and so why these questions are so interesting to you?
So I just started about 2 months ago. I am David's executive assistant and project manager, but I do not have a background in finance. I actually have a biology degree. A lot of my experience is in biology. So this is all kind of new to me, but it works out really great for me being an assistant because I'm very organized and I look at things in systems. But I'm learning like right along with all of you. So
right. And the fun thing about this, so there's we have a lot of systems behind the scenes, right? So you've learned some about that. And then there's a lot of things that they are actually quite difficult to turn into systems.
Oh, yeah. I think that there's a predictability to biology. I specialize in mammalian physiology, and that's kind of a closed system. I think when you have so many moving parts in finance and like investment and stuff, and a lot of it is out of control, it's really hard to pin it down and predict it.
Yeah, it's fascinating to have you describe it that way, by the way, because because I've been in it for so long, it's just become a tolerance of mine, is that there's a certain amount of unpredictability that is standard. I recount back to originally, I went through the phase of trying to somehow figure it all out, as if the stock market was an equation that could be solved. If you could just somehow get all the variables and lay them out on paper, and then it would balance and you would unlock this secret of the universe and everything would be clear. And I have since learned that is really, it's more like some of the modern day theories of like, thinking of like physics, honestly, when you get into the weird concepts of string theory and so forth, and this idea that the behavior changes when you observe it, but until you observe it, it could be a lot of random things, and the market, I swear, behaves like that.
Yeah.
I just swear, there's elements of chaos where you're like, no, it works like this, right? I'm like, maybe. And then you go look at it, and it does something different, and you go, never mind.
Yeah, well, and I do understand that part of it. Like, a biologist's motto is always maybe, because you never want to say, like, you're 100% sure, because there's always those, like, outliers.
I'm thinking of the term was quantum physics, by the way. I'm sitting there calling the sub-theories, like, string theory. But quantum physics, this idea at the tiny level.
Quantum physics is a fun one.
It's wild, right? But it's still strangely parallel to the way markets work, because remember, markets actually hate exploits, right? Anytime that you think that you've figured out a hack to the market that's going to work, it tends to disappear because everybody's racing toward that hack. And as soon as it's discovered, then everybody starts using it. And then that discovery stops being novel and it becomes mainstream, and then it's no longer an exploit. Right? It gets worked out of the system, and typically very, very quickly, because you've got so many people looking at the system at all times.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the questions that I did have for you today was, so how much of the market is changing on its own accord, and how much of it is changing by people's panic and reaction to it? And the panic and the reaction is really what's actually causing the change, and not just the market itself.
Well, it's a fun question. If we get really down to it, you got to keep in mind that the market in and of itself has no ability to move itself. It's exclusively the people that are making exchanges back and forth between each other that alters the price, right? If everybody stopped trading for a moment, the market essentially stops. So it is entirely driven by the fact that individuals and institutions are constantly transacting with each other, and they all have different motivations for why the transaction is occurring and different requirements. And the thing that I think really throws people off is those requirements are often time bound, and they don't have the same time or reason for doing what they do. And that's what makes the market. So it's like literally the fact that, you know, today I need money for something, so I better sell something so I can buy something else. Tomorrow I don't need the money anymore, so I don't have to sell anything. My behavior completely changes based on external circumstances that may not even be the market itself driving it.
So it sounds like there's multiple parts to the market, right? There's the people actually doing the buying and the selling, but then there's people who are investing in it. How do those two different pieces of it, I guess, change the game? Because if isn't it a thing where people they'll hear something on television or, you know, oh, this company is going under, and everyone goes and panic sells the stock from that, and it actually has an impact. I guess, could you explain the two different sides? There's the market side of the people actually buying and selling the goods, and then there's the investor side of it.
So I think, are you kind of hinting at what we talked about earlier today?
I am trying to.
Okay.
How
so
am
I will help you
okay?
out here because because I just had this moment of well, the people are the market, and you're like, well, how's the market different from the people? Well,
yeah.
It's so let's think about it more like the reasons people have, and then how that makes a market, and because the behaviors are sometimes different, I'll just go into what started this entire pathway. I was talking with Emma earlier, and the conversation was about the difference between time horizons and what do you do in a panic moment. Okay, maybe not panic, but it all started, I guess. I want to kind of start with where it really did start.
Yeah.
Which was this idea that we are at war with Iran, and it mm-hmm. started with kind of a political lecture, right? Because I'm lecturing a little bit that if what I think is going on is going on, it explains the war really clearly. And what I suspect, and again, history will prove out more so whether or not this was true, and it will prove out to the extent that information is allowed out or leaked, right? Or
yep.
or framed, for that matter, because maybe we never get the full story. It's hard to say anymore. But if Iran was very close to attaining nuclear weapons, then that could have been a very existential threat, because they're primarily run by a theocracy that is radical. And my definition yeah. of radical in this case is that they cannot tolerate anybody else's ideas but their own, and their solution is to eliminate them, right? There's no negotiating with somebody that says, if you disagree with me, I kill you. So there is no compromise in that situation. And if you give somebody an existentially threatening weapon, then everybody's in danger. And this is one of those scenarios where literally, domestically, the shores of the United States, you're in danger if that were to happen. And if that's the backdrop, then you kind of go, well, then war gives you very limited options. Or you have very limited options with an opponent like that, because it's like, well, we're not going to negotiate. We're going to keep doing this thing regardless of what everybody else tries to pressure, because we have a religious calling that's at a fanatical level that says you have to die if you disagree with us. Okay, that leaves very little wiggle room for negotiation. Essentially, you do what you're doing now, which is then we will go in and we will eliminate your ability to create weapons that are existentially threatening. And then Emma says, okay, but what does that do to the market? And I said, well, that's a fun question, right? Now, am I tracking? Is that about where it started?
Yeah, definitely. Because I'm over here. I almost know what I don't know, but not quite.
Okay, so the question is what to do. And the question I asked back is, should you do anything at all? Now, if you're wondering to yourself, should I do anything at all? We'll answer that. But I'm already looking at the clock and going, hey, perfect time to take a break. So we'll do that. We'll come back. And then, Emma, your job is to help me stay on task here.
Okay.
And answer the question, should I do anything at all with war happening and I'm an investor? Okay. Let's answer that when we come back. I'm Dave Littlejohn.
Emma.
and Emma's here too. And you're listening to The True Well Show on News Radio 92.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.
This is KQEN Local Talk at 4 on News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.
Hey, gang, welcome back to the True Wealth Radio Show, where we are having a special edition today on Monday. And so we'll have the podcast posted probably early tomorrow. So we'll see. Maybe it'll still be on Wednesday because, you know, we got a schedule for stuff here. But today we're mixing it up. And Emma, you're asking about how does war affect investments?
Yeah.
Right? Or the markets. Actually, you said the markets, not investments, I think.
Yeah. Because I feel like there's always kind of like some kind of low-level war happening at all times.
Mm-hmm.
My question was, how big does a war have to get? Like, how many resources does a war have to take up? Or how big politically does it have to get for it to start influencing the market? Is there like a threshold there? Where the market starts like really reacting to wartime, or?
So I would say it's less of a threshold than it is at what, because, you know, big is one of those terms that's like, well, how hot is hot? How cold is cold? How big is big, right? Like, so if I'm reading between the lines of your question, though, it's what's the point at which the impact starts to be noticeable on our market? And I think the first thing is, there's a little bit of if you think, then it becomes, right? It will act as if. Does the market perceive that there will be a problem? It's very interesting because when the Ukraine war happened, it was non-domestic. And while there was some disruption, it didn't have a significant economic impact on the United States because a lot of it was several sort of links down the economic chain. So, okay, well, there were some rare earth minerals and some grains and things like that that would impact the system. But we weren't sending troops. We were just sending resources. We still had other sources of grain domestically, that kind of stuff. So it didn't melt us down a whole lot. We noticed the effects of the start of the war. But then we kind of got over it and it just got implemented into the system. We just sort of absorbed it and kept going. And it's still going to this day. And we're kind of like, you know, look at that. It's now we just, well, are you going to wear the flag pin or whatever? And Russia bad? I don't know. That's but it's become, we're almost anesthetized at this point. Like we just kind of know it's in there. And so we already have that built into our assumptions.
Yep.
This war with Iran is a whole new set of assumptions. And I think the big enough, to air quote it, has to do with the fact that it's disrupting energy.
Yeah.
Right? The Strait of Hormuz is that how you say it? Is like 20% of the oil gets trafficked through there. And that disruption is a material impact on the flow of oil. Well, oil is the you know, base resource for energy. And so that's a huge input cost into all businesses. So if you think about it and say, well, our energy cost just got destabilized and went up a whole lot. Now that's a systemic change. And so then the question is, well, then how long is this going to be disrupted and how significant will this disruption be?
Yeah. And you were, so there might not be a threshold with the size necessarily of the war, but you talked too about how, like with stuff like energy, that there is a personal threshold where people start to make decisions differently. Like when oil gets up high enough, more people start to consider solar because it makes sense now.
Yeah. Well, it's just a math question, right? If it costs you $100 to put up a solar panel, well, let's say you can produce enough energy that you offset the, you know, I'm saying this poorly. Okay. I have to burn a barrel of oil to produce X units of energy, or I can put this much solar on a roof somewhere and produce the same amount of energy. And if that barrel of oil is $100 a barrel and my solar system costs less than $100 equivalent for the same power, my solar was cheaper than the oil. So people could actually justify doing the solar generation because it's cheaper than oil. So the higher the oil goes in price, the more alternative energies make sense. Now, if oil goes back down in price, then you reach a point where, oh, well, I can get oil for $45 a barrel, and it's still $150 equivalent in oil to put in solar, then the math doesn't work anymore. So there's some economics to substitution. And if the economics work, then people will substitute. And substitution's a common economic theory, by the way. I mean, it's well established that, you know, if you can't afford steak, then you can get hamburger. If you can't afford hamburger, then you get chicken. If you don't have chicken, then you have peanut butter, right? And like down you go with the substitutions. So, and that's how the marketplace works. This is supply and demand until there's a threshold at which too expensive. My demand for steak at $5 a pound is different than my demand of steak at $50 a pound. So you'll sell less steak to fewer people, but it doesn't mean $50 a pound won't sell. It just means you won't sell as much of it. It doesn't actually mean you'll make less money, by the way. If I can have 10 people buy a pound of steak each at $5, it's the same as one person buying a pound of steak for $50, right? It's just the number of customers and how many units transact. So it doesn't mean that the price becomes inelastic, but it does mean that the balance of the number of customers and the number of units that move changes, right?
I think that makes sense.
Oh, well, I mean, that's the basics of how the economics work in any system. We just have this tendency to want to, well, it gets complicated because there's so many different transactions, right? We were just talking about steak mm-hmm. and oil, but how many things do you buy in life? How many things go through a person's ecosystem in a day?
So much.
Yeah, it's a ton of stuff, you know, and you think, okay, well, I'm driving a vehicle. Yeah, it needs fuel, but it also needs, you know, replacement parts at some point, and it has all the different components that go into that. And the vehicle's taking me to soccer practice because soccer practice needs, you know, shoes and socks and shin guards and soccer balls. And like, I mean, it just keeps expanding and expanding and expanding. So,
yeah, that's, and maybe this is a question that we can put a pin in for later, but that was another thing that I was going to ask you about today is that sorting all of that out. There's so much information. There's so many things to invest in. That's why you do things like have models, right? And make portfolios to kind of sort out some of that. Is that correct?
There's some of that, but think of it like if you walk into a grocery store, you essentially have the raw ingredients to buy, to make almost anything. Right. If you go into a modern day supermarket, there's so much stuff. With the exception of specialty items that require specialty stores, you have enough stuff that you can have a huge menu. And, you know, you can make whatever you want from Greek to Italian to, you know, everything in between. And you go, there's all these different things with the raw ingredients. The challenge for a lot of investors is the stock market in general is a little bit like walking into a grocery store without a list. You just see everything. And then you go, great, now make something with this. And you go, wow. And you tend to default to things that are either pre-made or mm-hmm. you default to things that you know about. Because mm-hmm. the rest of it's overwhelming because there's so much choice. So having a strategy is like walking into the grocery store with a list and saying, you know what? I need certain items to make the thing I want to make. Mm-hmm. And as a financial planner that also does investment management. So we do money management internally, meaning we're not farming it out to a third party. So we're not hiring somebody else to be the chef. If we're doing the chef stuff ourselves.
I love this analogy.
Then I have to go into the grocery store and find the right ingredients to make the dish that we're trying to design. And the whole planner connection is like when a client comes in, they're saying, hey, help me determine what I should put on the menu and what I'm going to have. So, okay, well, let's talk about what you're in the mood for. These are all silly analogies, but it kind of works, right? Is, oh, well, let's figure out what are you allergic to? What do you like? What do you hate? How hungry are you?
Mm-hmm.
How long are you willing to wait before the meal gets prepared? There's all these different considerations. And then we come back and say, great, well, then here is the menu that we would recommend and we'll make the dish for you.
Yeah, I love that. And I think, like, not to take the metaphor a mile past how what mm-hmm. is due, but that's kind of like your investment committees that you guys do. You guys sit around and you talk about how to tweak the recipes.
We do.
Need a little more salt here, a little more butter in this one.
That's really it.
Yeah, I love that.
And if we kind of get it back to the real life nuts and bolts, you are assessing the whole landscape and saying, okay, well, economically speaking, the chicken looks affordable right now and the beef looks expensive. It's like, well, then let's make a chicken dish.
Yeah.
Right? Because it's our money goes further.
Yeah, you're cooking seasonally.
But make it really great. And so, the restaurant analogy still kind of plays out. But that's what we're really doing for all of our clients is we're trying to figure out what is it that suits you and let's build that. The trick is that our firm operates a little bit more like a restaurant than a grocery store.
Mm-hmm.
So when somebody comes in, it's a little bit more like, well, here's the stuff that we keep on our menu because this is what we're good at, right? So we know the style of food and we know the menu items. And maybe we hold the salt or maybe we add a little extra butter or something for your particular order, but it's still largely in the same genre of what we do. I joke and say, you know, you don't go into Burger King and ask for a taco.
Yeah.
Right. No. And so if somebody walks into our firm and says, hey, I understand that you guys sell hamburgers, I'd like a taco or a pizza or something, then we go, well, that's not what we do here. And if people mm-hmm. go, well, look, I mean, if I go in the kitchen, you seem like you have all the ingredients to make this thing. Why don't you just make it for me? And the answer is, well, we don't make it for you because now our chef has to do this thing just for you. And he can't manage everybody else's orders in the kitchen at the same time.
Yeah.
So that's why we kind of keep it organized by saying we have a menu. It's pretty broad. It meets most people quite well. But some people just come in and say, nope, can't do it. I'm allergic to that thing or whatever it is. And we go, I understand. Unfortunately, we're not the place for you. It's rarer than you think that we run into that, but it does happen.
Yeah. If you're allergic to shellfish, you don't go to a seafood restaurant.
It's true, right? It's true. Well, and the other thing is funny is like you don't go to a restaurant and then ask to go back in the kitchen and cook it yourself.
Yeah.
Right? If you want to cook it yourself, go to the grocery store, get the stuff that you want and take it home and cook it, which is totally cool, right? I mean, if you're a great chef, go do that. And you're quickly figuring out, right? This is the difference between, hey, do I want something that I'm going to make for myself or do I want something that I'm going to have made for me? The difference is the services that come with it. And, you know, you don't have to deal with the dishes. You don't have to deal with a lot of mm-hmm. things because somebody else is handling it, but you did pay them for it.
Who wants to wash the dishes?
I hear that there are people that don't mind. I'm with you. I'm like, I do the dishes because somebody has to do the dishes.
Somebody has to do the dishes.
You know, it's like not everything is fun, but hey, you know, you get through some of those things to get to the fun things.
So would you say that like what's going on in the markets right now when things are changing, would that be like changing ingredients? Like the food is changing. Like it's starting to go out of season. It's starting to get cold. Those tomatoes aren't as ripe anymore. Or would you say a different analogy is more appropriate? Like,
well, I think you could, we can carry the analogy as far as we want to, right? I do think that having the it's kind of funny to say, but yeah, like you get into certain market environments where you're like, oh yeah, those tomatoes, those are bad. You don't want those right now. You want to wait for a better time when they're in season. You know, that can be real. That's the equivalent of, you know, an investment becoming unattractive for whatever reason. You say, well, you know, it's not that I hate tomatoes, but I don't want those. You know, let me come back when the tomatoes are in season and they're ripe and it's the right time. I don't need them to be, you know, rotting. There is seasonality is not the right term for it in investing because seasonality actually means something.
But oh.
Yeah. Well, it means something in terms of timing. Like seasonality okay. means the same way your power bill may be more expensive when the air conditioner is running in the summertime than in the fall when it's not running very much. So your power bill may fluctuate because of seasonality. Right. We see companies that do tax services. They make more money during tax season and less money off season. So that's what seasonality
sense.
Means in investing, as opposed to our supermarket analogy for ingredients, which is why I'm kind of careful the way I say it.
Got it. Yeah, that could get confusing fast.
Exactly.
Thank you.
So just trying to, you know, not mix our metaphors so much that our listeners go, you lost me on that one.
I hope they're still following.
I do too.
So I think that's such a great metaphor.
Yeah, well, it's really simple to understand. You know,
yeah.
We all kind of deal with it.
Yep.
And if you just consider that the supermarket's all the different investments, you know, and it doesn't matter which one we're picking now. It's like, well, you can get all the different types. The question is, which ones did you want? Right. And the answer is, well, it depends on what you're building. Some people just say, like, I only want potatoes. Like, that's it. Just give me potatoes. I'm like, well, you can do that. But if the potatoes go bad, that's all you got. So, you know, the diversification still works, too. You want a balanced meal. So it's more interesting and tends to work out better for you.
Yeah. Diversify.
There you go. Right. Well, you know, or pick the one stock that's going to go up a kerbillion percent in the next 10 years and just own that, I suppose. But
you're like a superfood.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a little bit harder. It's definitely GMO, right? We're going to be careful with that. People are going to talk. All right. Look, we're running long. Let's grab a break. When we come back, because I promised Emma we'd find a way to get to this, I'll tell you about the weather and what that means for investors. I'll give you a hint. It's another parable. Stick around. I'm Dave Littlejohn.
Emma Arndt.
And you got True Wealth on News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.
This is KQEN Local Talk at 4 on News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.
Hey, gang, welcome back to the True Wealth Radio Show. Dave Littlejohn in studio with
Emma.
All right, Emma. And so Emma is quizzing me today, and we're speaking in parables.
Yeah.
Parables to help folks that I often talk about the markets, and we just go straight at it and, you know, kind of talk about here's what's going on in the economy, here's the elements, here's how they connect. But today, I think we're trying to do this on purpose, right? To just make this accessible. Maybe you're new to the markets, and this is just an opportunity to say, well, help me understand this a little bit different. And it turns out Emma's newer to the firm. So these are all questions that she's like, hey, I like that. Let's go with it. So what's next?
Let's talk about the weather.
I'm laughing.
There's nothing, you know, there's no better small talk than talking about the weather, right?
So not what she means.
No, it's not.
All right. Since we're speaking in parables today and we're trying to help folks understand the markets in a different light, it's all started with the question, remember, how big does the war need to get until the markets care?
Right.
And that opened up the idea of what does big mean for a war? How does the market assess whether or not it cares? What is a market? All of those things show up in there. But within the market, what makes the market care about something? And this is where the weather analogy sort of snuck in when we were speaking earlier. And Emma's like, please share it. Please share it.
It's
like,
so good.
I don't know if it's that good, but I'm gonna try to get it right again.
I think it's good.
I have this tendency to speak in a stream of conscious fashion at the office. And then people say, will you say that again? And I'm like, I don't even know what I just said. So radio show prep is hard for me.
Yeah.
The issue with the market is not everybody is playing the same game. There is a difference between investors and traders. And I think what happens is the market media, I sometimes refer to this as financial pornography, right? All the different news sources out there, they need you to look at their news story now, right mm-hmm. now, because that's how they get your eyeballs so that they can send them to advertisers. So we have to get your attention now. And if everything is about what is happening now, we are going to start shortening your time horizon as an investor because you are going to be worried about what is happening now. The very first question I asked today, if I recall, was should I or shouldn't I do anything? Right? There's a war. Should I do something?
Yeah.
Is there something to do? And the answer is it depends on your time horizon. Are you an investor or are you a trader?
And can you explain what that?
Well, I'm going to try to use the weather as our example.
And it's trader, right?
Not traitor. Trading.
Yeah.
Frequently trading in the market, shuffling in and out of things.
Yep.
I used the analogy of the weather to help explain something. The weather day to day fluctuates a lot.
Yeah.
But weather patterns, or the climate, if you will, is generally more predictable. We expect, if I say something is in the tropics, you get a picture in your mind of what that looks like. If I say something is in the Arctic, you get a different picture in your mind.
Oh, yeah.
Right? You understand those two different climates. Now, in the tropics, do we ever get cold weather?
I mean, every once in a while.
Yeah. It's rare, but it's happened. There were reports of snow in Florida, right? In northern Florida. So we've had some times where you go, wow, that is really not typical, but it's not impossible. It's just improbable. Now, here's the issue. In Florida, 99% of the time, it's pretty hot. Mm-hmm. So you don't build a house designed to hold 10 feet of snow on the roof in Florida because it doesn't make any sense, right? You build a house based on the conditions that are most likely to occur consistently. Here in Oregon, if you're out on the coast, you build a house that can withstand a lot of wind because that's really common. Yeah. I mean, 60-mile-an-hour winds are Tuesday, right? That happens all the time on the coast. So you would not build a house that couldn't stand up to 60-mile-an-hour winds. You would expect it to fail if you did that. You have to build a house that can withstand 125-mile-an-hour winds or more because that can really happen.
Yeah.
So there's a whole different climate that requires a different type of construction. This to me is a little bit like what investors need to think about is what's the investing climate that you're building your investments for? And so when you are planning a long-term investment, you're talking about building something that is stable and durable for the climate that you're in. Traders don't build houses. Traders are a little bit like putting up a tent in Florida. And then there's a hurricane coming, so they take the tent down and move.
Yeah.
Now, it works temporarily to set that tent up and then move it somewhere else. But that's kind of how traders work a lot of the time, is they move into a position, right back out of the position. And they're not trying to make a long-term investment victory. They're trying to get a short-term profit and then go look for another thing. It's like farming versus hunting. That's another simple analogy, right? The farmer isn't looking to grow the crop in the next day or two.
Yeah.
The hunter is. The hunter's out there looking to be successful right now. Yep. And the success is defined by figure out where the game is and take it down and harvest it. The farmer is looking at the weather and the long-term patterns. So the weather matters different, right? The climate matters for the farmer a lot more than the weather.
So you're a farmer.
We're farmers.
Me too.
Yeah. And that, Emma's legitimately a farmer, by the way. You know, that biology background of hers. But that to me, it's all the same kind of metaphor is, should investors do anything with the markets being upset by this war in Iran? And my sense is there may be some subtle things to do, but I don't believe that it's required to take significant action if you put a lot of the quality infrastructure in from the get-go, right? You bought quality companies, you're diversified, you're cost averaging where possible, you have a mix of conservative and less conservative assets depending on how soon you need to take the money, right? If your investment time horizon is still 5 years from now, I expect this Iran thing will be in the rearview mirror within 5 years. It doesn't mean that Iran won't still be unstable in its own way, but the war portion should be over.
Yeah.
Right? Or it should be, much like the Ukraine war, contained in a way where our economy has absorbed it and you'll simply tolerate where it is. So in that respect, I would suggest that doing something, you should have already done it. You know, if it reveals to you that what you did in the first place was wrong, maybe it reveals to you that, oh, I'm not as aggressive an investor as I thought. I shouldn't have been trying to play a game that I didn't understand. And now that I'm experiencing volatility in the market, I realize this isn't for me. Okay, then you just experience what some do, which is the wake-up call that you thought you were a more aggressive investor than you are. The problem is that the market lulls you into that belief, right? When everything's good, oh, I can be an aggressive investor, everything's good. And then the markets go down, and then you panic, and then you sell, and you get more conservative. And then the markets go back up, and you panic that you're missing everything, and you sell and go buy back in just in time for the markets to roll back over and go down again. And this is a great way to lose money. Great way. Right? Warren Buffett has a saying for people like this. He reminds them, the markets are very efficient at transferring money from impatient people to patient people.
Yeah. It sounds like it takes a lot of fortitude, a lot of mental fortitude to withstand that.
I think you could call it that, fortitude, or you could simply say that you need to understand how long it takes to nurture your crop, right? If I plant a crop and then a flood comes and washes it out, that's a different story, okay? But if I plant a crop and then it rains a little bit and then the sun comes up and it rains a little and the sun comes back out and I'm expecting that crop 6 months from now and I'm a month into it and I don't see anything, so I just dig it all up because it's just pointless. And I would say, that's just being a knucklehead, right?
Yeah.
Like, you're not farming anymore.
Yeah.
You never understood the life cycle of what you were doing. And so you are doing too much when you should be not doing anything.
So there's life cycles to different investments that you make.
I think that there are time horizons where you simply want to give the market adequate time for returns to occur, right? Expecting the markets to return things to you really quickly, it could happen, but it doesn't always. That's why investors look at things and say, well, over the next, you know what? I have a way to sort this out for everybody. Like a frame up that if I change this frame up, then you'll go, yeah, that makes sense.
Okay,
right?
I'm ready.
Okay, good, because we'll take our last break first. And then when we come back, we're going to make sense of this farming analogy in a way where you can go, okay, I'm with you. Stick around. I'm Dave Littlejohn.
And I'm Emma.
And you're listening to True Wealth on News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.
This is KQEN Local Talk at 4 on News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.
Hey, gang, welcome to the home stretch of the True Wealth Show. Today, pinch hitting on a Monday. So if you're wondering, who are these guys? Normally, we're on Tuesday, but we're glad to talk to you today. Emma, So you've got this farming background, and we've now talked about how investing is kind of like the weather, and you got to navigate the difference between weather and climate, long-term and short-term. Talked about how investing is more like farming than hunting. Trading is more like hunting. Investing is more like farming.
Got to have more patience.
Right?
Or patience in a different way, I guess. Long-term patience versus short-term patience.
And then we started to talk about, well, how do you build something and what does long-term mean and so forth? And while there's a whole bunch of metrics to it, when I talk in investment language, here, watch this. If you want to get, some of you will get it, but a bunch of people will be like, what? So if you start mixing together different asset classes with different correlations and different ratios in order to optimize the amount of return you get per unit of risk that you're taking, and then you have to select a time period over which that occurs, and then if you're really going to get exotic, you're going to try to do a tactical projection of where things are going and then assess whether or not you need to reweight those assets based on those expectations, you can see how I'm going to lose you really quick.
Oh, no, I got it. We're
perfect.
Good. That was, yep.
Okay. Well,
understood
that's
all of it.
That's what we do, right? And then the rest of it is like the math and everything that goes behind that. But let me kind of paint the picture a little different. Let's use an asset that most people are familiar with, your home.
Yeah.
Okay. Very few people can make money trying to trade houses. Right. It's very difficult to say. And because there's the cost of acquisition and the cost of distribution. Right. Hey, if I'm going to sell it to somebody else, there's still people involved. Even if I sell on my own, there's usually an intermediary. There's title expenses and so forth. And so what people tend to assume is I'm going to buy this house and I need to own it for a while. I need to own it for a while because there's tax benefits to owning it for a while. I need to own it for a while because that's how real estate appreciates in value. And so they walk into it with the assumption that this house will be more valuable in the future than I purchased it. And so that's how I'm going to make some money on it. And if it's a rental property, somebody else is going to help me pay for it. So there's all those different rationales for how they're going to make money with that real estate. Fairly straightforward. Now, I'm not going to get into the exotics of trying to use leverage or strip equity out to buy more things and, you know, how that navigating taxes. That's all more fancy stuff. I just want to talk about the house as an asset. We understand that to be longer term. People get, I believe, talked into viewing their investments on a short-term basis because that's the way the media treats it and because year over year, people like to see growth look predictable. You're used to, if you've seen treasuries or CDs or bank accounts, people like to see that predictable return that every year it goes up a little bit. But then they hear that the stock market makes more money than that. And they've heard somewhere that people day traded their way to a fortune. And so there's this desire to do something to somehow make the investments that you select grow faster or never experience market volatility, which is code for pullbacks in value.
Yeah.
If you purchased Apple stock 30 years ago and you bought, you know, $10,000 worth of it 30 years ago, you're probably close to a millionaire right now. And or more so. If your stock falls by 20%, the people that bought it 30 years ago kind of shrug their shoulders and go, well, it's still a lot of money.
Yeah. Yep. Because for them, it'd still be a lot more than
but the
what
person
they bought
that bought it,
right?
A year ago and it falls 20%, they go, oh, no, right? I've lost 20%. Well, first of all, you only lose if you sell it, right? Because you're, you know, now you've given up the asset. And here's the thing that gets me. People actually will say, well, no, because you've lost value. If you had to sell it, you couldn't get the value back. So, okay, that's accurate in that snapshot in time. But remember, you get to choose what you're willing to sell it for if you don't have to use that money to live on. That's why long-term investing is interesting, right? So seldom do people think, well, I have to sell my house so that I can go eat I'm not saying it never happens, but we don't design our lives that way typically. We design right. housing as an expense, and we assume that we're going to hang on to it until we need to move somewhere else, or until we decide that we're going to sell to get money out of the house because we're going to do – usually, again, you're still going to move somewhere else. That's usually how that works.
Well, so I have a question. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's a silly question, but will you explain the, like, I guess the different nuances of risk? Like, I know that that's like there's like risk scores in how risky of an investment it is. Is it always just that sometimes more risky things have the potential to earn more money, or is that more?
I guess I got to do it fast because we're up on the clock. But let me give you the quick and dirty on risk. Risk means several different things. It's a four-letter word, and it doesn't all mean the same thing. Risk usually for the layman means how dangerous is something. What's the likelihood that it's going to fail and I'm going to lose my money? And that's pretty accurate. Okay. But risk also means how much is it going to fluctuate in value up or down? So the willingness to tolerate the swings up and down is measured as a unit of risk. And risk can be both positive or negative. So you could have the risk of making too much money also, which we never think of as a risk, right? But that's the reality is, if you have upside volatility, you typically have downside as well. That's the way risk works. Gotcha. This is a balance of risk and reward. So we need to sort of disabuse ourselves of the idea that risk is danger, and instead say risk, it's the danger that it could be on a downswing. Right? There is a danger of loss, but in a proper investment, it's more of a measure of volatility. Okay? So the more that the danger of loss, the more the market has to pay you to be willing to take that risk. That's what's really going on. Okay.
Got it.
Great subject for another show, but we're out of time for today. So in the last 10 minutes, I'm going to say, if you have more questions, give us a call, 541-375-0898. Thanks for tuning in. Until next time, I'm Dave Littlejohn, and
I'm Emma Orange.